Privatisation. A talk given by Ronald Burgess, Director of the Economic Study Association, in September 1984.
Privatisation is a new word introduced by the present Conservative administration to distinguish their approach to certain economic issues from the approach of the other parliamentary parties. Like all such labels, it tends to obscure. So I will begin tonight by looking behind the label, privatization. In this 20th century, a common form of macroeconomic order is the trading community. This is to say, a community in which the units of production produce an output primarily for sale and not primarily for the consumption of those directly engaged in a particular process of production. The United Kingdom is such a trading community. A characteristic common to these trading communities is that the return to labour, take home pay, wages, call it what you will, the return to labour is a private personal income. It accrues to those who supply the labour, a necessary factor in all productive processes. And those who supply the labour may dispose of this labour income as they wish. The condition of slavery is today an exception, and this country is not one of the exceptions. However, we may distinguish between trading communities by reference to property income, the income that accrues to whoever enjoys property rights over the non-human means of production. At one extreme, we may envisage a trading community in which all the property rights to the non-human means of production are vested in the state. In this circumstance, all property income is public revenue and available to government for the financing of public spending. At the other extreme, we may envisage a trading community in which all property rights to the non-human means of production are vested in private persons or private corporate bodies. In this circumstance, all property income is, like all labour income, private income. This creates a problem for government, and indeed for the trading community as a whole. In the process of production and trade, there does not arise automatically any public revenue available for government for the financing of public spending. The problem is usually resolved by the trading community accepting the need for government to impose by force, or the threat of force, an arbitrary levy on all or any private incomes, as it may, in its wisdom, decide. This is what we call taxation. In the absence of an automatic public revenue, the government appropriates a tax revenue, which is used to finance public spending. In the early stages of a developing trading community, the incidence and amount of taxation is unlikely to be the cause of major distortions in the economy, or be the direct cause of substantial personal hardship. For example, at the beginning of this century, United Kingdom taxation appropriated less than a 10% share of the national cake. But as a trading community grows and develops, it has to start spending increasing sums on securing its trade routes. And at home, more roads, street lighting, police force has to be paid for, whilst the industrial areas and expanding towns require more and more money to be spent on such things as public health. As public spending grows, then so also does the tax take out of which this public spending has to be financed. during the interwar years, United Kingdom taxation appropriated around a 25% share of the national cake. A more important cause of a sharp increase in public spending, and of necessity in a trading community in which both labour and property incomes are generated as private income, a sharp increase in the tax take. This comes when the social conscience is aroused by the inevitable and growing disparity between a few very rich and a many relatively poor. Nature does not bestow individual abilities equally as between one person and another. Thus, even when only labour income is generated as private personal income, there will arise a spread of income as between the well-endowed and the not so well-endowed. But in this case, nature does impose a limit. No person can work every day for more than, say, 16 hours a day without losing edge. Everyone has to cease work in order to sleep, eat, and it's beneficial to take a holiday from time to time. Irrespective of ability, the amount that can be truly earned by a person from their labour is limited. No such limits apply to property income. Property rights over the non-human means of production may be accumulated almost without limit, and property income is generated 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, year in and year out. Thus, in a trading community where both labour and property income are generated as private income, there arises with a near inevitability a few multi-billionaires counterbalanced by a mass of underprivileged close to the poverty line. At first, the social conscience may be smoothed by gift from the rich, but soon there arises demand for government to do something. A popular demand is for redistributive taxation. The Robin Hood concept of robbing the rich to give to the poor. But this cannot reduce the disparity. For however good may be the intentions of government, taxes are, by definition and in practice, arbitrary. Some poor may become richer, and some rich may become poorer. But equally, some poor will become poorer and some rich will become richer. There is only one certain outcome from a policy of so-called redistributive taxation. The slice of the national cake appropriated by taxation will increase, and the rest of the community as a whole will be the poorer. Eventually, there arises demands leading to what we call now the welfare state. Public spending on a wide variety of social services and social security payments. Now, welfare state does work to mitigate the worst results of poverty, but in so doing, it sharply increases public spending. And the kind of trading community we are considering, this means inevitably a sharp increase in the tax take. I trust I have said enough to demonstrate that in a trading community where both labour and property incomes are generated as private income, and public spending is financed by taxation, an arbitrary levy on those private incomes, then in this circumstance, there is an inevitable and persistent tendency from a variety of causes for the slice of the national cake appropriated by taxation to steadily increase. At this point, economic forces take over. irrespective of the intentions of government, irrespective of the basis on which taxes are assessed, the effective incidence of taxation, where it finally rests, is upon property income. As the share appropriated by taxation increases, so the share accruing as a disposable net property income falls. At the turn of the century in this country, we appropriated about 10% of the national cake by taxation, whilst about 40 to 45% accrued as disposable net property income. Today, it is taxation that appropriates around 40% of the national cake, and disposable net property income is left with between 10 to 15%. As one rises, the other fall. This is the way economic forces operate, inexorably. But what does this overall picture mean to the individual firm, the unit of production producing an output for sale? It means that at the margin, their revenue from sales after paying taxation is insufficient to pay a decent living wage to their employees and have enough left over to finance the new investment necessary to keep them competitive. If they have the political power, then they may get some protection from government, sufficient for their survival at everyone else's expense. They may obtain a government subsidy, which in turn must mean an increased tax take from the rest of the economy. If they lack the political power, then they go to the war. That is the way market forces work. But sooner or later, a basic industry, one whose continued production is necessary for the well-being of the trading community as a whole, a basic industry is endangered. Protection and or subsidies prove insufficient. And then it appears to government that they have no alternative but to nationalize. A political ideology may aid and abet nationalization, but, as Mr. Heath discovered, they cannot counter economic forces. With nationalization, whether it stems primarily from political beliefs or is wholly the result of economic forces, or some combination of those two, with nationalization, there is a fundamental change in the trading economy. It ceases to be a trading economy where all property income is generated as private income. For some property rights or the means of production have become vested in the state. There is brought into being what we call a mixed economy. Nonetheless, with the mixed economy, the financial difficulties of government are intensified. The property rights they have taken over generate not a property income, but a loss. That is why they had to be taken over. Further, the industry is impoverished by taxation and needs the injection of substantial funds to finance the necessary new investment. The loss, the funds for new investment, all mean more public spending. And more public spending means an increased tax take. With an increased tax take, more firms go to the war. More loss-making property rights to the means of production become vested in the state. More public spending, leading to yet further increases in the tax take. More firms go to the wall, and so on, and so on. Starting from a trading community in which both labour and property income are generated as private income, and public spending is financed by an arbitrary levy on those incomes, then economic forces cause a tide, carrying that economy ever closer to a condition in which all property rights to the means of production are vested in the state. A tide which carries that economy as a cockle shell from one extreme to the other. In the popular terms of today, from right to left. What then is a policy of privatization? In reality, it is an attempt to stem and turn back this tide. A proclamation that King Canute is alive and well, presiding over Whitehall. Is the 20th century Canute likely to be more successful than the Dane of the Dark Ages? Let us consider. Private persons and corporations will not, in general, pay out good money to secure property rights over non-human means of production, but are making losses. They are likely, however, to pay out considerable sums to secure property rights over non-human means of production that are making profits, that are generating a positive disposable net property income. Now, it is possible for government to turn a loss-making nationalized firm or industry into a profit-making firm or industry. By spending public monies, it has the power to improve efficiency and competitiveness, and, on occasions, secure that position by granting monopoly powers. These firms then become candidates for privatization. They can be sold off to private persons or corporations in return for a substantial capital sum. This capital sum will, for a time, ease the financial difficulties of government. But we know, as a fact of repeated experience, the government will soon dissipate these capital sums. And when they are gone, they are left once again with only the loss-making nationalized industries. Further, unless conditions in the trading economy have been radically changed, the same economic forces that caused the newly privatized industries to be nationalized in the first place will still be at work. In time, it is to be expected that these newly privatized firms will once again become impoverished and either go out of production or be re-nationalized. King Canute demonstrated to his courtiers that wishful thinking will not turn the tide. Equally, wishful thinking will not turn economic forces. Privatization may appear enticing and even successful in the short run. But in the absence of radical changes sufficient to turn economic forces, it is in the longer run a futile policy. Yet, whilst all this may be so, the immediate issue is that in this flowing economic tide, industry becomes the beach ball of political ideologies. whether a firm or industry is included in the public sector, or remains in the private sector, or is tossed backwards and forwards between the two, is determined by political beliefs and expediency. Successive governments have acted in this matter as if there were no economic principles on which they could base their decisions. This is to ignore the mechanism fundamental to a trading community: the process of striking a bargain from which the outcome is trade. On the one side, there is a seller wishing to exchange goods and or services for money. On the other side, there is a buyer wishing to exchange money for goods and or services. The buyer and seller come together and strike a bargain. Goods and or services move from the seller to the buyer, whilst the money, known as the price, moves from the buyer to the seller. When you walk into the local, your friendly neighborhood landlord pushes a drink in one direction across the bar, and you push a pound note across in the opposite direction. This is trade, the individual building block of which a trading community is constructed. This may be illustrated as in figure one. At the center, there is a seller with numerous customers. The seller supplies his customers with goods and or services, and his customers supply the seller with money. The arrow is, therefore, double-headed. So long as production and trade give rise to this automatic two-way flow, goods and services in one direction and money in the other, so long as there is this automatic two-way flow, then we have an operation that is best left to the private sector. The less government interfere in the operation, the better it is for all concerned. However, whilst the figure illustrates the general case, it may be observed that there are exceptions. In some cases, there is no automatic two-way flow. The arrow is not double-headed. The flow of goods and or services in one direction does not automatically give rise to a flow of money in the opposite direction. Special arrangements have to be made, and where this is so, then it is best for the operation to be included in the public sector, so that government may make these special arrangements and apply them to the community as a whole. Let us take as an example the local fire brigade. You return home to find your house ablaze from top to bottom. Only one thing is certain: regardless of whether you call on the services of the fire brigade or not, you will be left with no more than a pile of ashes. Now, if you have to pay for the services of the fire brigade, why call on them? Why add to your already certain loss? If anyone is going to benefit from your calling the fire service, it is the other householders in the vicinity who, as a direct result of the fire being contained, are not left with a pile of ashes. Surely, justice demands the price of the service to be paid by those who receive the benefit. But how is this price to be assorted as between all the householders who benefited? Even if this is resolved, how is the fire service to enforce payment? When the fire service presents its demand, is not the householder entitled to say, "Yes, I did benefit from your service and thank you very much, but I did not request the service. I have struck no bargain with you, and I do not see that I am obliged to meet your demand for money." There has to be some special arrangement by which the service rendered to the community by the fire brigade is paid for by the community that benefit from that service. The two-way flow will not arise automatically as a result of a bargain between a willing buyer and a willing seller. This issue as to the firms and industries that should be properly be included in the public sector has not aroused much interest in the Anglo-Saxon schools of economic thought. Professor Prest, for example, devotes a whole chapter of his book, Public Finance in Theory and Practice, to the matter of allocating resources as between government and the rest of the economy. He concludes, "The very bareness of the economic principles set forth will make it clear that we are now on the borderland where economic and political considerations meet and mingle inextricably with one another. Recent years have in fact seen the publication of various ideas by economists on the appropriate principles of voting, on the grounds that one simply has to seek a political solution to these issues. But the issue as between public and private sectors in a trading community is essentially an economic issue, and economists are falling down on their job if they attempt to opt out of economic issues with a few smooth words." At the turn of the century, there was a lively debate amongst continental schools of economic thought, and the issue was put most clearly by a French economist, Paul Leroy Bewley. He wrote, "A new branch railway exerts a beneficial influence over a very wide sphere. It increases the receipts of neighbouring lines which it feeds and augments the income not only of those who use the new line for the transport of their products, but also of those who do not send their products any distance away, but simply bring them to the nearest market, which is now less gutted. Thus, the effect of the branch line is widespread, diverse, and manifold. But the entrepreneurs cannot make all the beneficiaries contribute to the cost, since many of them derive no direct benefit from the new line, nor even manifestly use it at all, simply stepping into the place of those who do use it. This is why many public works cannot be carried out for private account. They would ruin private entrepreneurs, whilst being highly remunerative for a society as a whole." Thus, 80 years ago, Leroy Bewley illustrated the fact that there are certain economic activities necessary for the well-being of a trading economy as a whole, which cannot be carried on within the private sector. Such activities cannot be carried on within the private sector for the reason that private persons or companies cannot collect payment from all those who benefit from that economic activity. If, in these circumstances, a private company attempted to collect the full cost from whosoever it could collect the payment, then it will price itself out of the market. As a result, go to the wall unless rescued by government using taxpayers' money. Special arrangements have to be made so that those who receive the benefit pay for the benefit received. This is the distinguishing characteristic of a public sector operation, for the special arrangements can be made only by government, acting on behalf of the trading community as a whole. In making these special arrangements, government must, of necessity, go outside of the tax system. By definition and in practice, taxes are arbitrary levies. To finance public sector activities out of tax revenue results inevitably in some going rich on public goods and services received but not paid for, whilst others are impoverished by being forced to pay for public goods and services they do not receive. The details of these special arrangements is a matter covered in our weekly seminars. In a public talk, I can do no more than point to the direction in which a solution may be found. I draw your attention to our much maligned system of local rates. As at present levied in this country, local rates are a tax. Their incidence as between ratepayers is arbitrary. In particular, rates are most burdensome tax on those who improve and develop their property. In England and Wales, the evils are compounded by the failure to carry out full revaluations at regular intervals. There have been only two revaluations of property since 1939. We have now reached a stage where a full revaluation on the present basis only makes matters worse for the individual ratepayers. Hence the outcry in Scotland. But investigations show that all these injustices arising from the imposition of local rates flow directly from the basis of assessment. They are not inherent in the rating system as such. Most important, in relation to the subject for tonight, is that throughout this century, whenever a full revaluation has taken place, then aggregate rateable values for the country as a whole have been found to have increased in step with the aggregate of local government spending throughout the country. In other words, the evidence suggests that rateable values in aggregate reflect the quantity and quality of the goods and services provided by local government. It follows, if the basis of assessment was changed so the rate ceased to be an arbitrary levy, ceased to be a tax on the developments and improvements to property, then the reformed rating system would provide government with a special arrangement needed to charge those who receive public goods and services the current market price for the public goods and services they receive. ESA researches suggest that this is the way forward towards a solution based on economic principles, so that self-interest serves what justice demands. A practical alternative to the varieties of political solutions based on political ideology or political expediency. A policy of privatization may offer some short-run advantages, but it is an attempt to swim against a strongly flowing economic tide and cannot succeed in the long run. If we object to being carried ever closer to a state with a centrally controlled economy, in which all the property rights to the non-human means of production are vested in the state, then radical reforms have to be made, sufficient to remove our trading economy from that tidal race. But more immediately, the government should at least base its privatization policy on economic principles. Privatize only those firms and industries which should, and in the right circumstances could, operate within the private sector. It is the height of foolishness to base privatization decisions on whether a firm or industry is making a profit and can for the moment, therefore, be sold off in the marketplace. Public finance in theory and practice. To the matter of allocation is essentially an economic issue, and economists are falling down on their job. He wrote, a new branch cannot make all the beneficiaries contribute to the cost, since many of them derive no. Such activities cannot be carried on within the private sector for the reason the private person of a public sector operation, for the special arrangements can be made only by the details of these special arrangements is a matter covered in our weekly seminars. Been found to have increased in step with the aggregate of local governments based its privatization policy on economic principles. The reformed rating system would provide government revaluation on the present basis only makes matters worse for the individual ratepayers. Attempt to swim against a strongly flowing economic